What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
When someone you love is facing cancer, you want to do more than send a card or flowers that will wilt in a week. You want to actually help. That's where the BalmBox comes in. Our care packages are built from research with over 500 cancer patients and caregivers, packed with items people actually use during treatment. Think soothing, practical, thank goodness I have this kind of relief. For you, it's not just a gift. It's a way to show up in a moment where words fall short. For them, it's comfort, calm, and a reminder they're not alone. From chemo-friendly boxes to mastectomy recovery kits, even options for men, we've made it simple to give something that's elegant, premium, and genuinely useful. And yes, domestic shipping's always free on orders over $50, because making someone feel cared for shouldn't be complicated. So skip the empty get well soon. Send real help, real comfort, and maybe even a laugh. Visit thebalmbox.com. That's THEBALMBOX.com. Balm, like healing and care. The Balm Box. Because cancer patients don't need bouquets and brownies. They need Balm.
That's a gay ass podcast.
What? That's a gay ass podcast.
A what?
A really, really, really gay podcast that we call That's a Gay Ass Podcast.
That's a gay ass name for a gay ass podcast.
Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, the podcast that asks, whose fault is it that you're gay? It is me, Eric Williams, and this week I'm chatting with Brian Spitolnik, a therapist who specializes in working with gay men, but he was also a Broadway dancer for 15 years. So you know we had to talk about the theater of it all, and he does give me a lot of therapy, which ultimately does what? Lead me to tears. We do have an extended conversation over on Substack, where we ask some sex questions and body image stuff around the holidays. So please go watch that over at Substack. But for now, please enjoy this very therapy-filled, very gay-ass convo with Brian Spitolnik. Brian Spitolnik, a therapist for gay men, is on a gay-ass podcast. Brian, are you ready to be absolutely dragged through the mud?
Oh, always. Always, Eric, yes.
Because as you know, this is a gotcha journalism podcast. And my first gotcha question is, are the rumors true? You have a bachelor's in fine arts from one of the most sought after institutions in the United States of America.
Yes, it's true. I confess it's true.
Tell the girls where you have a BFA from and in what major.
I graduated from the University of Michigan in the year 2005 with a BFA in musical theater.
And Brian, I don't know if you know this, but producer Nathaniel and I myself, Eric Williams, both got rejected from said program. Brian, do you think you're better than us?
No, I really don't. A lot of people, we had a conversation, I had a gaggle of gays at this house over the weekend. We had a long conversation about Josh Groban, as you do. Josh Groban was also rejected from the musical theater program at the University of Michigan. Just a few years before I was there.
Okay, if I start crying, it's because not only does Umich bring up instant tears, well, not actually, but what does bring up instant tears is my first ever concert I went to was Josh Groban. I was like, because I never went to concerts. I was like, you know, like this like gay kid that didn't like Dave Matthews Band like the rest of my brothers. And then Josh Groban came to St. Louis, Missouri, and my mother and I went to the hockey arena in which he played, and I fucking listened to him sing his Italian arias, and I sat there comfortable. I didn't like to stand. And Josh Groban was like my girl. That makes me feel a lot better, Brian. Thank you.
I'm so glad. Yeah. So I don't think it's really a marker of all that you may have thought at the time.
And I agree. I mean, part of the problem is I had a voice teacher who was like, oh yeah, I've had people get into UMich, you're going to get into UMich, and then your life is set. And I was like, perfect, I can't wait. And then the audition was the scariest thing I've ever done in my life.
Fucking terrifying. Did you go to Michigan to do it?
I did. I went. And you know what's funny is at every college audition I had, the same ginger, not producer Nathaniel, the same ginger auditioned right before me. His name is Max Chernin, and he now just starred in the national tour of Parade. He was Ben Platt's understudy on Broadway. He got in everywhere, and I was like, okay, yeah, he's meant for this. And I did some musical theater for a little bit, but now I'm doing this and I feel like this is my right path in life. But I love
like
that
it's
you
going
and I
pretty well.
Yeah, I think so. And it seems that you also have a Broadway herstory, and now you're doing amazing things. And I want to talk about, of course, your life as a therapist for gay men, because I myself am absolutely obsessed with therapy. It has been my saving grace since I really was in college, and I'm still in it every darn week.
Good for you. I heard you say recently that your best relationship is with a therapist. Is that true?
I mean, I would say so. I've been very lucky, Brian. I've had my first therapist out of college was Fran Goldfarb. I was with her for 8 years, or 8 years.
Yeah.
Until she retired.
Wow.
And then, I just ended up ending a relationship with a therapist just out of like pure, this is a beautiful moment for us to like, it was 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
But listen, Brian, you're already turning the tables on me, and I gotta turn the tables on you.
Sorry.
No, see, I'm obsessed with it because I fucking love talking to therapists. but before we talk about your therapy journey, you were in a Broadway show for many years, and I need to ask about the journey. Are the rumors true? You did Chicago on Broadway for quite a long time.
15 years. Yes, I did it for 15 years. Now, that includes the pandemic, which was 2.5 years of not doing it. But yeah, 15 years from the time I was 24 until I was 40.
Okay, so wait, you booked a Broadway show at 24 years old.
And let me tell you, at the time, it felt like I had waited forever. I thought I was failing. I thought I was past my prime. Yeah, you know.
But because you had graduated college all of 2 years prior?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had friends who had graduated and done Broadway shows that fall, you know, so it was.
Wait, who did you graduate with that you were like so jealous over?
My very closest friend in college was Jenny Barber. Still one of my closest friends. You may not know her, but she's on Broadway right now in Beetlejuice. Actually,
Shout out, Jenny.
She came out of retirement to do Beetlejuice on Broadway, which I think is so fantastic.
Well, I'm sure you've probably had so many classmates who did the Broadway thing who have, just like you, pivoted to other careers because Broadway is famously not only incredibly difficult, but hard to sort of do forever. In fact,
it's
one
really
might say impossible.
Hard. Well, I could have done Chicago forever, I think.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of people there still who were there before me. Well, there's one person there who, big shout out to Sharon Moore. She was this, do you know who she is, this woman? She is the swing. So I was one of the male swings. She was one of the female swings. She's older than I am, has been there longer and is still there. And she's, you know, incredible. The point is I could really have died at Chicago. They probably would have fired me eventually, but I wanted to leave before they wanted me to leave. You know what I mean?
Why would they have fired you?
They do. they fire people. When they just kind of feel like it's time. And I mean, there are a lot of reasons to end somebody's contract, but people who have been there for a long time, it's usually about age, you know, it's usually about like, okay, we've come to our natural conclusion, and you know, it's easier to be fired because you get that severance. If you quit, you don't. Yeah.
Oh, well, okay. We love severance. But it's also, what a brutal business. I mean, can you imagine in any other job being told, hey, you're too old.
Yeah.
Hey, you're
too
blank.
My contract, I mean, the kind of standard Broadway contract says, you know, they can fire you when you no longer look the way you did when they hired you. And as I mentioned, I started that gig when I was 24. So you can imagine by the time I was 40, I did not look the same. So I just always had that awareness just kind of hovering over me of any minute now, they're going to realize you don't look like you're 24 anymore, you know?
Girl, talk about the, like, countdown clock. Talk about the, like, approaching gun to your head. I think that it's a crazy crossover, too, with the queerness of it all, because so much of your work with gay men and just people in general is the idea of, like, being told what our value is and being told, like, where we get our sense of self from. And you're having a literal job telling you, no, your value is looking a very specific way. And, well, and Chicago
just
people are
really, you really said it really well just then, because that is why I became a therapist, because of seeing the men in my show who, when they were fired, completely lose themselves. And and there were a few men in particular who killed themselves after they were fired. And it was, you know, obviously, like, you can't even say how horrifying and awful it was. But it was, I mean, in my interpretation of that, my understanding of what that was always, who am I without this thing that has defined me? And that was, you know, that was always hanging over me as well. So
I can only imagine. I mean, it's so hard in general to be an artist. It is so hard to be an artist on Broadway. It is so hard to be a queer person.
Period.
And then, I mean, there must be some, like, secondhand trauma too of seeing those people get fired or leave the show, and then whether they end their lives or lose themselves. I mean, it is making a lot of sense why you decided to pivot, because that was one of my questions. Like, what... but, you know, I feel like I do want to get into those, but as a gay-ass podcast host, I think it would be against my religion not to ask you the famous gay-ass podcast question, which is, Brian Spitalnik, whose fault is it that you're gay? Who do we blame even, babe?
There are so many answers to this question. I have been just racking my brains. I mean, the real answer is it's my dad's fault. My dad is not a gay man. He's a straight man. And my parents are still married. And my dad is a lover of musical theater and art and culture, and music and dance. Oh yeah. He's one of the good ones. And he was raised that way, you know? And he was born in a very small upstate New York town where, you know, little boys were not supposed to like art and culture, but his mom would drive him to the other town, you know, I don't know, three towns over to take ballet class when he was a little kid. He stopped that eventually because it was too difficult, but, you know, he majored in oboe at Oberlin Conservatory. He then became a social worker, and then he became a lawyer. But the point is, the reason it's his fault is because he was also a part of the community theater in Potomac, where I grew up in Maryland. And he would take us to what?
Potomac. I'm sorry. I watch Bravo. How could I not have an answer?
I've never watched it, but I'm told it's not the Potomac that I grew up in. That's what I've been told.
You're not a wealthy black woman. No, I'm sure there are differences. But yeah, no, Potomac just kind of pings for me. But community theater, your father.
Community theater, yeah. Do they show the community theater on
Yeah, there's actually a huge plot line about who's going to be cast as 8-0-Annie.
There should be. Anyway, so my dad, because my mom was working always, and... you know, they both worked. So on nights when my mom wasn't home and my dad had rehearsals, he would take me and my two siblings to rehearsal with him. So there he was, you know, rehearsing in the ensemble of Pajama Game. And my siblings and I were, like, learning the choreography along with them, you know. And the girl who sang Steam Heat, she could belt, she could kick her face. You know, I thought she was 104. She was probably 25. But I was obsessed with her and I wanted to be her. And
that woman was Betty Buckley.
What if it would be more accurate? Like, that woman was Karen Ziemba. You know what I mean?
And that woman was Karen. And that woman, I mean, we could just start naming
Everybody.
Angie Schwarer.
Oh, well, and forget about it. Actually, yes, it was Angie Schwarer. Yes, exactly right.
I have to say that you are hitting on something really important, which is that the power of theater over a young gay boy, because I would say that I can blame the same thing, which was my older brother playing in the pit of Once Upon a Mattress. And I, at the high school when I was in sixth grade, and I went and saw it, and I was like, not only is this a Broadway production, these people are also 48, they're 16.
Right.
And I was like, I need to be up there and ultimately need to be a grown gay man eventually. But that sort of came later. But I love that you have the theater in your literal DNA.
All the reasons that we love theater are all the reasons that it's hard to be gay. You know, it's larger than life and it's not quite real and it's... not societally acceptable, really. You know, that is where we belong. That's the groove that we live in. And so, of course, I was drawn to theater. Of course, that's
what was your before you get into UMich, before you move to New York and book Chicago. You're in high school. Brian Spitalnik plays what roles, and what role did you absolutely devour?
Oh, senior year, I was the leading player in Pippin. I wore the Ben Vereen jazz pants. It was, it was my peak. Honestly, Chicago was not my peak. That was my peak. And I kind of felt that at the time because I was never going to be a leading man. I was always a dancer first. That was my thing.
Really? I mean, yeah. Sitting across from you now, I can see leading man, but you know better than me. You're
no, I never had the voice for it. No, my voice was never going to do that. It was, it's loud. I I can be heard at the back of the house.
Sure.
But it's not pretty. So it's just never where I was going.
Wait, can I say something that is really pretty about you, Brian, that it's important, is that you have a really great nose and I've been noticing it in your videos, and I just needed to take a moment to let you know that the schnoz is schnozzin'.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad I didn't change my name or get rid of my nose, which I wanted to at 22.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Wait, which one did you want more, nose or name?
I think
and
nose.
What's wrong with your, what's wrong? Oh, your nose. I mean, listen, I have this show that I will plug now. I'm doing it in New York at Joe's Pub, March 20th. And I'm doing it Chicago, Seattle, San Francisco. And I have a whole part of the show about my nose because I broke it twice.
Oh.
I did get the job done in high school and carried a lot of shame about it, but like also I was made fun of for having a big old nose, and also I was like a Jew. There's a very you know, sort of
right
on the nose stereotype.
Right.
And so when I saw your schnoz on in profile, I was like, damn, great nose. And nice to be able to appreciate a good nose in a man, you know?
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I kind of was anticipating a lot of anti-Semitism as a chorus boy. Because like, how many Jewish chorus boys do you know? There's not a lot of us. You know a lot of Jewish producers. You know a lot of Jewish songwriters, but not a lot of
They're not
dancers.
Casting their own in the ensemble.
They're not. Well, there just aren't a lot of dancers. Like, you're not, like, what Jewish mother is like, my son, you know, it's not where
my
it's going.
Son will be able to kick his own face.
My parents luckily are like that. But yeah, that's why I wanted to change my name to something nice and goyish, you know, my nose.
What would it have been?
I played with like taking my dad's middle name,
which is
Alan. So it would have been Brian Allen. But like, I mean, and I said that, oh, my friend Jenny Barber again. I said, you know, in our senior year, I was like, I think I'm going to change my name to Brian Allen. And she goes, who's that? And I was like, me. And she's like, no, it's not. And I was like, oh, okay, you're right. It's not me.
It's Brian Spitalnik, bitch.
You say that so beautifully. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It rolls off the tongue. I mean, Brian Spitalnik. You were meant, though. You were meant for a life of staying true to yourself, but also helping so many others. Because it really, I asked you to be on the pod because not only do I love therapy, but I also love how specific how specifically you help our community. And I think that there are so many parts about being gay, a gay man, a queer person, that we sort of know in our psyches as like obstacles, but we don't actually dive into them. And you say it very succinctly and well. So I have a lot of questions about those topics, about sort of the obstacles we face as gay men. But before I do that, what was the experience for you becoming a therapist? How long did it take from you finding out that Chicago was in fact not going to be reopening during the pandemic because no Broadway shows were? How long did it take you to go from like, oh fuck, I'm out of a job, to what's my identity, to oh wait, let's become a therapist?
It actually started before the pandemic. The truth is I had been trying to get out of Chicago since like 2 years after I started. I was auditioning for the first 2 years, you know, and just assuming I would start booking Broadway show after Broadway show, and that didn't happen. And the things that I was booking were not a dream come true. I booked a movie called The Big Gay Musical. And I did that movie, and on set, I started studying to take my graduate exam, entrance exams, because I was like, this can't be where I'm going. This can't be it. So, so the long story of that is I was really trying to get out for a long time. And then finally, when Jeff Lefaholtz, died, when he killed himself in 2018, I took a leave of absence. I had an injury. So I took a long leave of absence, a whole year. And I was like, okay, I'm really going to do it now. I'm really going to find something else that I can do with my life, because that was terrifying. And I can't, you know, I can't just sit there and wait for my life to be over. So I went to LA with my then boyfriend, and we like took some meetings, you know, like we were trying to write and produce, and that was demoralizing. Came back and I started therapy for the first time. I had never been in therapy really. So I started therapy, and my therapist wrote biographies. And he was, you know, a psychologist in his 60s, but he like on the side published like biographies of political figures that were real books and really well received. And I was like, oh, I could be a therapist and do other things. So that's when it started. So I started applying for graduate programs for therapy or for social work in the fall of 2019. And then I got in the spring of 2020, and it just so happened I had a lot of time on my hands.
Wow. So that was Brian. The time.
Yeah.
You did two things there. You like listen to your gut, and then you also let the universe guide the way. And that's sort of.
Well, my gut sounded a lot like terror, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I've not always been awesome at knowing the difference between the two things. I've not always known what is fear and what is, you know, gut self talking.
You're speaking my language. That's exactly my same cross, my Jewish cross to bear is, you know, learning how to hear what is my actual gut saying versus what is my survival sort of like screaming sound in my head being like, save yourself. It's but I think what also is so relatable is like you were on the set of my Big Gay Musical. Is that what it's called?
The Big Gay Musical. Yeah.
So sorry. The number one Big Gay Musical. And you were like, there's gotta be more to life. Stacey Orico said it best. And I had that feeling during the national tour of the Grinch musical when there I was wearing a fat pouch as a costume. And truly thought to myself, this can't be like, this is the dream, the in quotation marks dream,
right?
So many people audition for this and I'm being paid this, and
did you sort have of fun?
You know, well, I'm not going to get into the whole thing, but it truly was 2014. I did Elf the Musical as Buddy the Elf on tour, and that was the dream. I had the most fun I'd ever had in my life until that point. And then the next year, they decided not to cast me because even though I did every performance, I had what I thought was maybe like a concussion before a show. What really was, it was a panic attack, but I had hit my head and I was starting to be like, what if I pass out on stage? And the producers of the show had been in the audience that night and they had heard that I was struggling right before the show. And I did the show and I fucking killed it. But the next year they told me they didn't want that to happen again, and they were not going to have me go out on the road again.
Whoa.
And I was devastated. And I was still auditioning, and I booked the Grinch tour as, like, the understudy of one of the leads in the ensemble. And I was just like, "Who? What the fuck? Like, what is going on?" And I ended up doing Elf again 3 years later as, like, a fuck you to them and to prove to myself that I could do it again. Mm-hmm. And I had a much better time, like, emotionally doing it the second year. I had already decided I wasn't doing musical theater anymore. So it was sort of like, this is my doing it for myself and not for them. And then within 2 years after that, I started to plan this podcast, and then my life sort of dramatically changed. So I know the plight of being somewhere that really you just know in your bones it does not align with where you want to be.
What happened to the anxiety, to the panic attacks?
You know, that's a good question. Two things happened is that I got on Lexapro, and I also dealt with the very real panic attack feeling in therapy. And the woman I just stopped working with really helped me understand whose voices I was hearing and the physical sensations. And the first, you know, speaking of that solo show, the reason why it's a big deal emotionally that I'm doing it on tour is because the first live show I did, I had panic attacks. I had my body was like, "You're not safe. Do not do this. Do not do this."
Sure.
And after the first time I did it, I said to my husband in the car right after, because the show went really well, and I said, "Matt, the molecules of my body are changing."
Oh, wow.
I was like, "I feel something shifting."
Yeah.
And I was like, "My body, like, I didn't die." Mm-hmm. And it actually felt like this is what I'm meant to be doing. Like, this is it. And and that is what I needed. And so I still feel the fear very deeply.
Yeah, because, you know, that you know, I work a lot in parts, you know, IFS, internal family systems. And, like, that part of you that doesn't feel safe is never going away. But you can teach that. You can teach that old dog new tricks, you know. You can teach the other molecules to kind of have safety in places that never felt safe before.
That's what I've been trying to do, is figuring out the ways that when I feel deeply unsafe, what are ways to remind that part of my brain, like, hey, the feeling is going to continue to be there, but the reality is that it's okay. And that's why, like, I'm continuing to put the stuff out there that really makes me scared shitless, is because I know that there's another side of it. I know that there's, like, the like, touching my body. I'm like, "Oh yeah, I'm still here."
Right.
I'm still here. You know, like, it's a constant struggle for me. It's very much my own survival thing from growing up gay in Missouri and growing up with, like, parents who love me so deeply but wanted me to be safe by not putting myself out there in many ways.
It's interesting. There's a reason that I'm able to speak so specifically to these fears, is because they're so common to, now we do not have a monopoly on this kind of anxiety and fear and desire for safety. But gay men have it very specifically, even men who grew up in very liberal, loving households and, you know, were born in the year 2000, you know, in, like, you know, our Gen Z and all these things, and things are different now. They're not that different. They're still living in a homophobic and heterosexist world. And so they are not safe in certain places. And that lives in your body. How could it not? So the thing that you're talking about learning to be able to tell those parts of you that didn't get to grow up, that you grew up, actually you, the self of you, grew up and you are safe now and you can take care of them. That's the whole ballgame. That's the whole thing.
This is why I love therapists, Brian. You're making me cry. It's just like, I really still grieve for the child in me that, like, just like did not feel safe, you know, like did not feel like okay to just express myself. I mean, it's really, that's like the hard thing that I sometimes have, I guess, anger about, maybe, is like, is like, you know, God, why did it have to be that way? Like, why do I have to feel such alarm bells in my head now, mm-hmm. when what I'm really doing is like putting out a comedy show or a mm-hmm. podcast or just like why does it have to feel? But it's, you know, we can't control
what happened. We can't control, yeah. you know, the world around us. But what would it be like for that little boy to see you now? Like, can he see what you're doing? You know, like, what does he think about what you're doing at Joe's Pub and these podcasts?
Yeah.
How would he
God,
react?
I haven't even really. Yeah. I mean, it's very like Drag Race when they show the photo of the young version of himself and they sure. say, what do you want to tell little Brian? Let me put it on you, though, Brian. What do you think the young version of you would think about what you're doing now?
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays, decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa, got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments, Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels, Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
When someone you love is facing cancer, you want to do more than send a card or flowers that will wilt in a week. You want to actually help. That's where the Balm Box comes in. Our care packages are built from research with over 500 cancer patients and caregivers, packed with items people actually use during treatment. Think soothing, practical, thank goodness I have this kind of relief. For you, it's not just a gift. It's a way to show up in a moment where words fall short. For them, it's comfort, calm, and a reminder they're not alone. From chemo-friendly boxes to mastectomy recovery kits, even options for men, we've made it simple to give something that's elegant, premium, and genuinely useful. And yes, domestic shipping's always free on orders over $50, because making someone feel cared for shouldn't be complicated. So skip the empty get well soon. Send real help, real comfort, and maybe even a laugh. Visit thebalmbox.com. That's thebalmbox.com. Balm, like healing and care. The Balm Box. Because cancer patients don't need bouquets and brownies. They need balm.
The young version of me would have been so happy that I danced on Broadway. Just period. Even if I had done it for a minute and a half, he would have been yeah. so stoked. I think he'd be like, a therapist, okay. Tell me more, you know. Go on. What's good about that? But I think he would have understood why. You know, I always, even though I was so narrowly focused on making my way to Broadway my whole childhood into early adulthood, I also mm-hmm. had a lot of parts of me that were like kind of scrambling to make backup plans. You know, I never quite trusted that I could do it. There were parts of me that didn't want to do it. So I think at any age that I was, that kid would have been not too surprised and happy that I was doing something that was meaningful to me, I think.
I think in the entertainment industry, it's just full of landmines emotionally. Mm-hmm. And I think that allowing yourself to pivot is one of the most important things to do. And yeah. I think that you booking Broadway, just like so many people book it and then realize that, wait, this is it. And not like that it's like bad, but it's just like, oh, it maybe didn't feel as much as like I have arrived as I thought it would. Mm-hmm. And so allowing yourself, I didn't book Broadway, but like booking the Elf tour, I was like, oh, it's not exactly how I envisioned. Mm-hmm. Like my yeah. life is certainly not easy
right.
after doing
right.
that show.
And there may have been, you know, the version of you who existed at 14 and 15 years old may have been totally happy doing Elf all those years with no complaints. You know, that is what happens when we train to do something from the time we're four to the time we're, you know, in our 20s. What we want changes, and what we think is fun changes. And especially when you've taken something that was your fun. For me, that was my fun, dancing and being in a show. And then you make it your profession. And there are things that are not fun about work, you know, And so you had to grow up.
Well, yeah, and also work is work is work. And so it's like, mm-hmm. it's like everyone hates their job at one point, no right. matter if it's like whatever it is. Yeah. But I do want to take this opportunity to get into some of those topics that you touch on, sure, in your videos online that are so well done, but of course, in your work with clients. One question about working with clients that I have as someone who loves therapy, how much are clients asking you about your life as a gay man? Because you're relating so much of our experiences, mm-hmm. I don't ask my therapist very much about their lives. Yeah. I have a gay therapist that is our couples therapist. We will sometimes see him both individually, mm-hmm. and I'm kind of obsessed with him. But out of respect and the whole shtick, I don't know too much about him besides that he has a partner. Mm-hmm. He's sometimes in Palm Springs, and that's all I got.
Yeah.
How much do you reveal about yourself to your patients, and how much are you being like, I can't tell you that?
Well, it is both, you know. I will tell clients something personal if it's helpful, if I think it might be helpful to them. And then after I say it, I will usually ask, is that helpful? And sometimes they'll be like, not really, you know, and I'll be like, great. That's as far as we need to go with that. But it's not usually that helpful. You know, the reason that there's that boundary there of, there's the boundary of clinical distance so that you as the client can put whatever it is that you need to work through onto the therapist. You know, that's why traditionally, like, you would know nothing about me. You wouldn't know that I had a partner. You wouldn't know that I went to Palm Springs, like all those things. Because it's more important that, like, if you have shit to work out with your dad, that you can just put that on me and we can work it through. That's a very traditional psychoanalytic model. And I don't work in that model. So I will... It depends on the client. Some clients really need to be joined in that moment. You know, they really need to know that I understand what they're talking about because I've lived it. For most of them, it's enough to know that, like, they don't have to explain what the underwear party is. They don't have to explain sniffies to me. You know, like, that means a huge amount. Most of the clients that I work with who have worked with straight therapists, period, it's not that the straight therapists weren't good. They were great. And now they just want somebody who understands this part of who they are. And I think that's great. Where it gets interesting is, you know, there are clients who, like, over Pride weekend in New York, they'll start telling me about what they're doing for the weekend. And I'll sometimes be like, oh, I'm going to be there too. So here's what happens if we run into each other in that context. You can always come up and say hi. I'm always happy to say hello. You can introduce me to who you are with. You don't have to. You can tell people who I am. You don't have to. I will not introduce you to who I'm with, but, like, that is up to you. I will take your cue. And that's an interesting thing to navigate. The kind of ethical rule around that is that if you're my client, Eric, and I see you at Flaming Saddles on a Saturday night, I'm supposed to leave. Like, I'm supposed to not engage and just leave the space. And because I'm a gay man working with gay men on this little island of New York, it's gonna happen, and I'm not.
You would leave every bar, go to the next one, see another client. You'll go to fucking some mm-hmm. restaurant and be like, "Fuck, I just ordered the entree."
Right. What's really nice, what's happening now because of doing this stuff online, is that guys are coming up to me at the gym and at bars and at restaurants and everything, and I get to talk to them, you know, and they're not my clients, you know? So that is really nice because I feel like I get to be a person, and I can introduce them to who I'm with if that feels right.
Is anybody inappropriately flirting with you because you are not only a gay man, but you're a hot gay man?
Thank you, Eric. Nobody does. I think because... I mean, I don't know why they don't, but my take on it has just been that, like, I'm not doing therapy with my shirt off. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not posting thirst traps. Like, it's very clear why I'm doing what I'm doing. And something about that boundary seems to have been communicated clearly.
I'm happy for you. I mean, I mean, I'm happy for all of us because it just we contain so many multitudes.
We
do. And I feel like
we do. And I love how gay men are horny. You know, like it's
me too.
Awesome. Yes, it's wonderful that we get to express that and be that. And but I'm also glad. You know, I very intentionally sexualized myself as a chorus boy in the Broadway musical Chicago for a very long time. You know, that was so much part of my currency. I'm so, so relieved not to have to do that anymore. I'm so relieved. And actually, you know, that's another thing like I'm really proud of, that I could go back and tell little Brian, like, you will not always have to use your sexuality to prove that you are worth paying attention to. You know
what's funny is that we're on sort of like opposite, we're like opposite trajectories in the sense that I never sexualized myself and now I'm starting to with some of my work. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing is I feel shame about it, but I also feel like pride and confidence with it. But I also feel like, are you just putting hairy tits because you have no talent? what is it that you do successfully? Like it's a little bit of that.
Talk to that part of you. See what it needs to know. Because see what it needs to be caught up about. The idea of, how old are you now? Are you allowed to say?
36.
Okay, I'm 36. Very much allowed. So the idea that you as a 36-year-old man could consciously bring your sexuality into your work and into your public persona, how cool. Instead of a very unconscious part of you being like, well, you're only going to be young for so long. You better shove this in people's faces. Yeah.
Literally. No, I prefer the like, let's celebrate that part. But I do love that you again like can normalize the horniness of gay men. You can normalize the fact that we express ourselves in so many ways. A lot of what you talk about with gay dating I find interesting too. Like I'm a married gay, but I have so many single friends and also people who listen to the pod who are in the dating sphere. Can I ask you what your status is relationship-wise?
I'm engaged to be wed.
Yes. Mazel tov, Brian Spitalnik.
Thank you so much.
You're engaged. Mm-hmm. I'm going to respect your privacy, but I want so many more details.
Well, I can tell you I'm getting married in May. But we're very intentionally keeping it offline, you know, in every way.
Respect and love
so
that.
Nice. Yeah.
How delicious is that? Yeah. Oh my God. Oh my God, Brian. A wedding in May. Mm-hmm. So much to look forward to in 2026. I think also there's a beauty of getting married when you are like a more developed brained person.
Well,
there's
such a difference. I've been in a lot of relationships and I've been out there, you know. Not all of my data comes from my clients and from, you know, research. As a graduate student, you know, I have my own data, and it's a really, well, it can be a daunting landscape.
Girl, especially right now, I think there's something about, you had a really great video about how having a list of absolutely nots is cutting off our chances of intimacy. And I find that for straights, gays, and all across the board that it feels to be an issue that might be the worst it's ever been because of scrolling and apps.
Well,
do you agree or disagree?
I absolutely agree. You can filter. I mean, just like you can in every sphere of your life now, you can filter out things that you do not want to exist. So, you know, so you're not, because of the, first of all, the distance that being online gives you, you never have to be in a space with somebody who you might not consider. Eliminating that possibility is really doing everyone a disservice. It's that coupled with the idea of what you do need in somebody. You know, I see that almost as much as the things I don't want. I see the things that I do need. And those are usually not true either. And I mean, yes, it can be like money and, you know, stable job and he has to be this tall. But it's more about like, well, I'm really all over the place. I need somebody who's really steady and who's going to ground me. That is codependence. And it's a model that a lot of us understand more than we understand interdependence or equality or mutuality. So I see that a lot. And so working to understand yourself enough to know, actually, I can be that grounded force for myself. I don't need a partner to do it. It'll be really nice if my partner is also grounded for himself.
So if you don't mind, we're going to, after we end this main ep, we're going to go over to Substack to talk about the sex-based questions, the sort of hard-hitting gay-ass journalist questions. But before we do that, I still want to talk a little bit more about what you are finding in the sessions you're having with these gay men. Another topic that comes up is age gap relationships, younger dating older guys dating younger guys. What do you hear are the biggest obstacles in those dynamics?
From the point of view of the younger man in the relationship, it's almost always about power dynamics. You know, there's mostly because they're not aware of their own power, of like their youth and their beauty and their energy. They're not aware of how much weight that could carry. And because the older partner more likely has a more established life and more established routine and kind of idea of himself, a younger person can really get lost in that identity. That's what I see the most from that end. From the other end, the older men more generally skew towards wanting to take care of somebody and start to see their worth as a, they don't see their worth outside of being able to take care of somebody financially or emotionally. It doesn't have to be both. Sometimes just one or the other. So there are a lot of places where it can, you know, there are a lot, just like any kind of relationship, there are a lot of places where you could go wrong. And there are a lot of intergenerational relationships that work beautifully because both men have a sense of wanting to be in certain roles with each other, especially at first. A man like wants to be mentored, a man wants to mentor. And there can be something really beautiful about that dynamic, and it can be quite healthy because there are other places where the younger man will pick up and meet him emotionally and energetically. But I think like any relationship that will also evolve, you can't stay the mentor after 25 years. You know, that has to shift. I think
that's the beauty of a long relationship, I think, too, is how the plot can twist.
It's got to twist because we change, you know, we're going to change together or the change is going to take us apart. You don't know, but there is work to be done to keep it in relation to each other. You can change and stay in the relational dynamic. And that is the work of any relationship, but particularly with, you know, if the age gap is 15 years, you've got to be looking at how you're going to be in developmentally different spots along the way. And so you could probably say that
about every relationship is going to have those things that you have to be cognizant of, whether it comes to age, whether it comes to finances, whether it comes to Matt and I are very different the way we see the world. Not only am I a Jew and he's a Catholic, I'm like expressive, chatty, over sherry girly. He's more sort of grounded and interior, you know. We have so many, I'm trying to take up more space, I'm like, you know, doing things that as a Southern Catholic, he was told, like, careful, girl.
Yeah.
So it's like my point is, like, every relationship, age gap or otherwise, you know, you have your topic, you have your buckets of, like, gotta check in, make sure, you know, as we're growing, we're staying present. And I will say, though, that there is more for us to talk about when it comes to the relationships and the sex of it all. But I'm going to keep that over for Substack. So let me ask you, for now, the final gay ass podcast question, Brian Svitolnik, is a good one. And it is. If the world was ending, you could only save one character actress. Who would you save?
Does she have to be currently alive?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. Okay, good. Okay, good. Because my immediate response to this is the late, great Madeline Kahn. So, yes, let's just take a moment, actually.
Thank you for saying her name.
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing her into this episode. Madeline Kahn. I mean, you really do. You're a good gay Jew with good taste.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. She first blessed me with her presence. When I was obsessed with What's Up, Doc? Because I was obsessed with Barbara Streisand. So I was also obsessed with What's Up, Doc? This is like I don't know, probably like I was 10 years old. And I, you know, you see Madeline Kahn's performance and you're like, who is this? And also, I get her. Also, is she going to make it through this movie? You know, to me, like that is what I want in an actress. I want her to be just on the verge of falling apart at all times.
Yep.
It's why I love Judy. It's why I love Bernadette Peters. It's why I love, well, really any gay icon. They're so strong and they're also on the verge. Are they going to make it through this song? Are they
great
going to make
point.
It?
Great point. Great point. Wow.
And Madeline Kahn, you don't think about her fragility much, but to me, it always looks like she needs, after that take, she really needs you to catch her. That's how I always felt.
Well, flames on the side of my face, I think you are worried for her. Mm-hmm. I think she is about to lose it.
She's so fully there.
Yeah, and I think that's Brian, really well done, because I've done this podcast for almost 5 years. I talk about character actresses every episode, and I have never thought about the idea that they are about to fucking lose their shit. They're on the brink. I think Jennifer Coolidge is a modern version of that, because it's like she's always like, are you okay, girl? are you okay? But listen, in the interest of time, mm-hmm. Brian, I know therapists are always very much in from hour to hour in need, so I want to end this so we can go to Substack. Brian, tell the girlies where to follow you, and if there's anything that you would like for them to know.
You can follow me on Instagram and TikTok. My handle is @Spitolnik, which is my last name. Is there anything else I want you to know? Oh, yeah. I have a gay mental health app. Did I tell you this?
I've been reading and researching. And I was hoping you were going to plug it.
Yeah. I'm really excited about it. We're getting a glow up right now. So I'm switching platforms. So it's about to be much prettier than it is right now. Right now, it's wonderful, and it's really created a lovely community, and that's the idea. It's a community of gay men who get together, and I'm doing once a week a live, we can't call it therapy because it's a coaching thing.
Sure.
It's a coaching platform, and I can't do therapy out of state, but it is basically the feel of group therapy, and these men are coming together every week and like joining each other and knowing each other and connecting to each other, and it makes my heart sing. So the app is called Gayfully, GAYFULLY. When is this podcast coming out?
Wednesday, December 10th.
Okay, so shit. Well, okay, so this right now, you might not actually be able to find it on the App Store, but let them search, because it'll be there again soon. I have a lot of hope for Gayfully. Because of all the things that you and I have been talking about, there's such need for connection and real community, but also real healing, you know, on the individual level. And my hope is by giving everyone the tools, therapy is expensive. You know, what if you just like had the tools and had someone there along the way with you saying like, yes, this is right. Keep going. Here are all these other men who are on the same journey. Let's talk about it. That's what I'm hoping to build. And that's, I hope, what other people are wanting to. So far, that's what I'm hearing.
It sounds incredible. And as you know, based on our conversation, I think that anybody would be lucky to be a part of that community. And I will absolutely be linking it and spreading the gospel and maybe even joining myself. So
please join. Brian, it's been wonderful to have you.
I mean, I'm so buying what you're selling, and not that you're selling, but you know what I mean. Brian Spitolnik, thank you so much for being truly a next level guest, and I hope we can continue. In fact, we are about to right now. So everyone go to Substack, and Brian, you're a gem.
Thank you, Eric.
Thanks for joining me on That's a Gay Ass Podcast, and thank you to Brian for giving me truly gay ass therapy. If you want the extended version of this interview, we chat for another 15 minutes over at Substack. Questions about sex and body image and dating and all of that. But also this week's bonus episode that was released on Mondays with Sam Altizer, a very hunky personal trainer who loves a big hairy belly. You know him as I'm Baby Lifts on TikTok, and it's already becoming one of the most popular episodes I've had on Substack based on how many of you sluts are subscribing for it. So please go to Substack to enjoy, and as always, stay gay.
Bye.
You've been listening to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, hosted by me, Eric Williams. If you want to see and hear more, make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and follow the Instagram at Gay Ass Podcast. For more gay assery, the real girlies are over on Substack, where you get bonus episodes every single week and live chats with me and other gay ass guests. That's a Gay Ass Podcast is executive produced by Eric Williams and produced by Nathaniel McClure. We'll see you next week.